It's Tuesday afternoon, so that means it's time for the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future Book Club. And with us once again, Mr. Buffett.
Indeed, Mr. Jimmy Buff. Here we are again.
You were back in town. You were away for a few days. You were in the Midwest?
I was in the Midwest. I actually was first in the South. I went to Atlanta to perform, and then it was Columbus, Ohio, and Indianapolis, Indiana.
How are those places these days?
Those places are feeling a lot of what everywhere else is feeling, or at least I'm learning as I go to these other places. It's really fascinating because there is a consistent story around really neighborhoods and communities, but I'll take it to neighborhoods because Atlanta, of course, is a big city. Lots of infrastructure, lots of potential supporters and that kind of thing. But you get into Columbus and Indianapolis and you hear the same stories that I heard in Detroit and other places where there was this influx of workers from everywhere in the early 20th century, of course, as these factories were coming online and world wars were being fought and just the steel and the glass and all the industry around what I learned when I went to the Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio, thousands and thousands and thousands of war machines being built. And it's impressive on a certain level, but overwhelming in terms of all that energy, whether it's people's time, effort, the money, all of it being spent on machines that kill other people. And that was a little overwhelming. And then you go into the communities like Columbus or Indianapolis and you see the people that once or that the children of or the grandchildren of the people that were pulled in to do this work, now there's no work. And the neighborhoods are still there and still trying their best to survive, but without the infrastructure and without really in some ways the entire city's buy-in to the necessity of surviving. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. It's a very difficult thing. I think we've talked about it before, but in the old days, the idea was how do we make sure the workers are respected and not exploited? And now it's how do the workers find relevancy in a city that doesn't need them anymore? And it's painful to see, but there's a lot of great, great work going on in these neighborhoods.
Yeah, and we've talked about that as it regards Detroit before, because the auto industry was like that.
Right.
And Detroit realizing at some point that no one was coming to save them.
Exactly. And what I've realized, really, and it should be obvious, I guess, to people that understand this, but Detroit may have been the epicenter, but this was happening everywhere. You know, and again, it's steel and glass is the thing I kept hearing. And that no one's coming to save them. And so they have to look to each other, look for alternative forms of currency and just what livelihood means, what work means, what purpose means. And it's interesting to see that being examined.
Yeah. And a place like Kingston, for instance, has been through several iterations in its history. The most recent was as an IBM town.
Right.
And I think the inclination is for people to look for the next IBM
exactly.
to come in, right? The
right.
next the
right.
next up cycle before
right.
the next down cycle.
Right.
But there are, there are alternative ways of looking at that, and that is right. this is opportunity now, right?
Yes. And as I think David Bullier said, but he may have been quoting someone else, the next big thing will be a lot of small things. And that those are words to live by, because the next big thing, whether it's here in Kingston or anywhere else, will be the small things, the efforts that that your neighbor makes, that we make together to create an ecosystem of possibility and opportunity. Because that's what nature teaches us, is that monocropping, you got to support it with a whole lot of other inputs and all sorts of other stuff. But when you have a diverse ecosystem, biosphere, whatever you want to call it, that's where life lives. That's where you can thrive.
Another David Brooks wrote a really great opinion piece last week that
yes.
as the president of the Radio Kingston board, you passed along to the staff of the radio station, and
right.
it was largely about the importance of the neighborhood,
yeah.
right?
Yep. The neighborhood is where it's going to happen. Again, small really is beautiful. And if you know your neighbor, you know yourself a little better, and you can start to recognize how people can basically remember that it does take a village. It takes all of us in different ways. The kids can play again out in the yard and all the stuff that only a neighborhood has to offer, I think, in terms of our future.
We've been airing chapters, audio chapters of the book Surviving the Future. It's subtitled Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. It's edited by Sean Chamberlain from the writings of David Fleming's masterwork called Lean Logic. We just wrapped up chapter 4, which is called Carnival.
Yep.
And ends with that great line, start with a party.
Start with a party. And that can be a block party.
It can be a block. It can be a lot of different things. But after the party brings us to chapter 5, which is called Slack Employment. And that's what Sean Chamberlain is going to say right now.
Fantastic.
Chapter 5, Slack Employment. But in the cold light of the morning after, can a party possibly form a basis for a functional economy at any scale? Well, as we shall see, history suggests that it has an important role, at the least. We have begun to explore the notion that slack is central to the resilience of a system. It enables it to cope with losses, and it makes space for choice. It is also needed in well-defined ways for that special case of resilience, a post-industrial lean economy. Now, slack in economics occurs in two forms. Unintentional slack. This is where the economy falls into depression, which, at its extreme, matures into hyper-unemployment. Post-market economics in part one raised the likelihood of this scenario after the climacteric. At the heart of such a situation, there is a paradox, since there is both glut and famine at the same time. There may, for instance, be an abundance of apple orchards, abandoned because no one has the money to pay the farmer for the apples he could produce from them, thus leaving abundant food-growing potential untapped, while people starve. Or there may be an abundance of labour with plenty that needs doing, and yet that plenty that needs doing doesn't happen, owing to there being, for instance, no fuel to supply the energy it needs, and or no money to pay for it. In a moderate form, and if the problem is the lack of money, this can be repaired, since governments can redistribute income to those who would otherwise have none, or spend heavily, or print money. In an extreme form, there are so many without jobs that there is not enough tax revenue to redistribute or spend, and any government temptation to print money will immediately short-circuit into inflation. Recessions are dark reminders, or precursors, of the failure of urban economics when the large city-based labour forces can no longer be sustained, since labour commands no price. Intentional slack, by contrast, is the case where an economy learns to coexist with slack. It might, for instance, work a standard 2.5-day week, and or use uncompetitive and labour-intensive methods of production, which consume fewer natural assets per unit of output. In an intentionally slack market, there is a deliberate decision to build and sustain a locally based economy with a much lower level of output and consumption than it could produce if it were taut and competitive. Its maintenance requires that work is shared out, that the inefficient technology is freely chosen, that nature is spared. This settlement, quite fragile, like our planet Gaia herself, is the core principle of lean economics. On a small scale, intentional slack can be done easily enough. For example, the informal economy of the domestic household is prodigal with labour, and if it had to compete on price, it wouldn't have a chance. Such inefficiencies would be wiped out in a moment. It works because price is nothing to do with it. And it is this kind of essential yet slack economy which holds out to us the possibility of a future. But it is protected by having opted out from the competitive market, and it is not easy to sustain such agreements at the large scale. Nonetheless, most human societies in the past, outside the taut, tense experience of urban civilization, have been slack in this sense, relying on things that are anathema to a competitive economy, local loyalties and currencies, collusion and cartel, culture, and confidence that it knows what it wants and where it's going, that it can choose how to live. Here, for example, is the historian Juliet Shaw's view of the mixture of working life and days off in the Middle Ages. The medieval calendar was filled with holidays. Official, that is, church holidays, included not only long vacations at Christmas, Easter and Midsummer, but also numerous saints and rest days. These were spent both in sober church-going and in feasting, drinking and merrymaking. In addition to official celebrations, there were often weeks' worth of ales to mark important life events, bride ales or wake ales, as well as less momentous occasions, Scot ale, lamb ale and hock ale. All told, holiday leisure time in medieval England took up probably about one-third of the year. And the English were apparently working harder than their neighbours. The Ancien Régime in France is reported to have guaranteed 52 Sundays, 90 rest days and 38 holidays. In Spain, travellers noted that holidays totaled 5 months per year. All this was backed up by a well-established ritual year. And when the rituals came abruptly to an end in the Reformation, the feast day slack was stopped too. In England by the Act of 1536, which allowed itself a rant at those who ought to be at work, being enticed by the licentious vacation and liberty of these holidays. A strong culture that can support slack has been in retreat ever since. But the inconvenient truth is that, as the economy now begins to decompose, we have to rebuild a slack society to take its place. The opening up of choice, not least choice in the use of time, allows the economy to be interesting in a way which is impossible if it has to make money with nearly everything it does. Leisure. Leisure, widely shared, has been the unfulfilled promise of economic development, a reward for mankind's achievement in, as Keynes put it, solving its economic problem. Some of the makers of the Industrial Revolution looked forward to the day when hard work would be over and society could devote itself to leisure. Men and women, it was confidently forecast by a writer in the Democratic Review in 1853, will then have no harassing cares or laborious duties to fulfil. Machinery will perform all work, automata will direct them. The only task of the human race will be to make love, study, and be happy. And yet, in a competitive market economy, a large amount of roughly equally shared leisure time, say a 3-day working week or less, is hard to sustain. Because any individuals who decide to instead work a full week can produce for a lower price. By working longer hours than the competition, they can produce a greater quantity of goods and services, and thus earn the same wage by selling each one more cheaply. These more competitive people would then be fully employed, and would put the more leisurely out of business completely. There would then be excess labour, and wages would collapse to zero. This is what puts the grim into reality. In other words, the slack economy is unstable. It could at any time snap back to taut full-time competitive employment for some, for a time, along with destitution for the rest. Consider, for example, this thought experiment. The case of the vanishing economy. Imagine that there is an economy of 100 people, all in their dual role as producers and consumers. Add three strong assumptions. 1. They are consuming the maximum they want to consume. If they had more money, they would not increase their consumption. This might be because, for instance, producers and consumers alike want to reduce their carbon footprint, or because consumers are feeling insecure and want to save any extra money, or because they use all their additional income competing for non-produced positional goods, those goods that by definition cannot be exclusively owned by everyone, such as unique and irreplaceable artifacts, works of art, or houses in particular locations. Assumption 2. They never believe each other's promises. And assumption 3. There are no unemployment benefits, so that the out of work simply die. Now, imagine that this miniature economy abruptly experiences a shock. There is a technological advance that doubles productivity, so that the 100 workers now produce twice as much as they did before. But as consumers, in accordance with assumption one, they do not consume more, so overall consumption remains unchanged. What happens? Well, the doubled productivity means that now only 50 people are needed to produce enough for 100, so half the workforce becomes unemployed. There are no unemployment benefits, so they die. That leaves 50 people producing and consuming. They are still working to the same doubled level of productivity, so they produce enough for 100. That is twice as much as is now needed, so half of them become unemployed and die. That leaves 25 people producing and consuming, and so on. Now, if they were sensible, they would all decide to work half-time. That would give them the same quantity of goods as they would get if half of them worked full-time, and it would share out the leisure. But they do not do that because they don't trust each other. They can't get an agreement to stick. They are conditioned by the market economy. They have to be competitive and cannot forego an immediate advantage from which they would individually benefit in favour of a future and larger advantage from which everyone would benefit. Competition now becomes a curse, frustrating all efforts at accommodation. But people are programmed to think only in those reductive terms. And that has particularly regrettable consequences if they are in a system which, when it is stressed, can become unstable. Thus, George realises that if he works half-time, Jack can steal a march on him and work full-time, earning twice the money, selling his product at half price and putting George out of business. Everyone is scared of opportunists like Jack, and they blame each other for forcing them to behave in this way. They dare not trust each other, so they cannot take the simple step needed to solve their economic problem and enjoy leisurely lives. This is why it is difficult to sustain a part-time slack economy. There are obvious practical reasons too. It would be hard for pianists, brain surgeons, tennis champions, and others with skilled jobs to maintain the standard they need if they only worked part-time. And challenging to monitor the working hours of the self-employed, such as writers who work at home. Unannounced visits by time wardens might be viewed with concern, and would anyway be less than fair since the working hours of the less skilled jobs, such as waiters, could more easily be monitored than the more skilled ones, such as philosophers. But the deeper problem is that agreements on self-denying measures, such as shorter working time or a deliberately inefficient technology, both of which require people to forgo immediate advantage, are hard to sustain. Everyone who stays within the limit, foregoing the opportunity to be more competitive, is a potential sucker. That is the core enduring ethic of the market. In the lean economy, however, that problem need not apply in the case of working time, for three reasons. First, the aim is not, in essence, to reduce working hours. It is to build the informal and local economy to the point that it meets the wants and needs which the declining market is conspicuously unable to provide. Indeed, the whole discussion of work and leisure makes more sense when it starts with the aim of increasing working time in the informal economy, rather than of reducing working time in the formal economy, which is on course to decline whether we want it to or not. Secondly, the lean economy will be fully aware that there are other ways of inhibiting economic growth. The use of labour-intensive methods, the selection of technologies for their minimal environmental impact rather than for their productivity, the discarding of surpluses through intentional waste, and various other strategies within the range of options open to the slack economy. It is unlikely that they will be needed to end the growth of the formal economy, but they will certainly be applied in the informal economies of the future. Thirdly, as we have seen, the lean economy is built on a strong culture and on social capital, underwriting a shared sense of common purpose and enabling it to make difficult decisions stick. It can sustain desirable aims such as more leisure time if it needs to do so. If the sophisticated information and energy technology of our time continues to be available, the way is open in principle to a benign and positive progress towards a steady-state economy. Technical advance can, in this context, open the way to reduced working time without the initiative collapsing in disarray. This is a society that can implement its decision to enjoy ever-increasing leisure with each advance in technology. Result, a culturally rich, steady-state, systems-literate, resilient society. At least, in principle. But the instability never goes away. Still, it is a core aim of lean economics to keep its choices and arrangements from unravelling, to restore to human society the power of decision, instead of being subject to the turbulence of competition and the opportunism of price. A decision to work shorter hours, the use of labour-intensive methods that can be done lovingly and in a closed-loop system, these freedoms are waiting to be rediscovered. There are snags, of course. Living in a slack economy supported by the culture rather than by opportunism is a skilled task. Many of the abilities needed for it are best learned in childhood. The potential for play, judgment, imagination, and manners must be activated early in life if they are to develop properly. But the narrow, targets-based education of the market economy simply passes them by. This means that more leisure could short-circuit miserably into poverty and resentment, or it could be sucked up by addiction to television and its related media, through which the time available to make a personal commitment to social capital or to a new political economic order is diminished. Having to build society anew from its very foundations is a challenge. When the builders don't turn up, the challenge is greater. The other major snag is that the advanced technologies may not be available. And yet, the possibility of a culture-rich, technically advanced, sustainable economy with the key accomplishment of slack, with time to think, is there. And with time for other things, too.
You know, listening to this chapter, it makes me think that we might have gotten it wrong from the very beginning.
Yeah. Well, certainly a long time ago.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, and when he brings up at the end about education and this idea of being programmed into this thinking, that's the thing. We have to break this programming that has only really been in place for 100 or 150 years.
Yeah. You know, my son will be 10 in February.
Yeah.
And I was driving him to school yesterday and something came up and he said, "Well, that's how life works, Dad."
Yeah. Oh,
and
my God.
I was like, "What?"
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. And but it didn't have to be how life works.
No, exactly. You know? And, you know, it's so funny because, when you read about, as Sean was saying, the thinking in the late 19th century when the Industrial Revolution was really kicking in and everybody was thinking, oh, we're going to have all this time. It's going to be great. The machines will do all the work. But what we didn't foresee is the level of consumption that could be easily sold to everyone. And then the level of distraction with radio and then television and beyond now, and you combine that with this, this sudden paradigm shifting thinking around survival of the fittest. And, you know, if you don't do it, somebody else will, and rugged individualism, all these things that were built kind of out of the 19th century that we still hold so deeply. And then school being this process of assimilation, so you're a good factory worker. We're living out of this programming. It's just as simple as that. And then distracted at the same time by consumption in all its form, which includes media.
Without a doubt. I heard a filmmaker some years back talking about sports and the American fascination with sports. And he's like, oh, thank goodness for that, because what else would people do?
You know,
if they didn't have that distraction, they would be focused on
what, themselves,
yeah,
their relationships, their children.
Or this system that really isn't necessarily working, right?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's a great distraction, and you're right. Yeah. I listened to an interview this morning, and it was, they were talking to various Trump supporters in different places and just saying, how do you feel now, basically? And it was this young couple who are still, or certainly one of them, still believers. And the guy was saying, well, they were being interviewed together. They're young, in their 20s, working two jobs. He goes off at like 7 at night and works until whatever time. And then she gets up and works through the day. And they have an hour together. And what they said they did in that hour is they watch TV. And I thought, Oh my God. I mean, you are not for 1 minute just sitting with yourself and your thoughts and your intimate partner and saying, how do we feel?
Yeah. And work as a metric of self-worth, like self-purpose, right? You're not worth anything if you're not working for something.
Yeah, this idea of the dignity of work drives me crazy. The purpose, you know, having a feeling of purpose and connection and meaning, all those things are true, and they often come through work in some form. But as Sean was saying too, you know, the domestic life is a huge factor in terms of the work and the time, and there's no economy at all. Nobody gets paid for that work, so... Yeah.
You know, again, my son watching, he was a big fan of Thomas the Tank Engine for a number of years. One day, my wife and I are sitting there watching it along with him, and it really struck us the very sort of English notion of work, because all the locomotives or the engines are very useful engines, right? And their worth is valued in their usefulness to the running of the railroad.
Right.
And and we, of course, have that here in America as well.
That's programming. That's programming your child.
Without a doubt. And when my son said to me, well, that's life, Dad, I thought, you know, there's still time for him to discover that that's not life.
Right.
Or whatever it was.
Quick.
Right. That we can hopefully reprogram. There are things at work now that are conspiring to make some of the things in this chapter, slack employment, way more relevant, like artificial intelligence and automation that are going to take jobs away that can't be replaced.
Absolutely. And workers right now, a lot of them that are basically one step away from being a robot. And they know it. They feel it. They don't feel like it's dignified or purposeful. And so we are very close to what can hopefully actually be everything that Sean and David are talking about there with a slack economy. But we have to trust each other.
Without a doubt. And trust, again, comes up in this chapter, as it has in many previous chapters. And I love the line, now if they were sensible, they would all decide to work half time.
Right. Right.
Sensibility has got to come into play here.
Trust and sensibility.
Right.
And really being able to, this gets back to the neighborhood, looking at each other, knowing your neighbor and going, okay, we're in this together. Let's do this right.
Yeah, and that maybe the way we've been doing it all along can evolve to a different place.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. It is Surviving the Future. It's the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future book club. We just finished chapter 6 called Slack Employment. It ends with a line, and with time for other things too. And other things is directed in chapter 6, which we'll get to next week, which is titled Eroticism.
Well, how about that? All right.
Thank you, Peter.